Welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine, California, in our news time slot from 5 to 6 on Thursdays. Mind Your Own Business with Jackie Painzik and Cliff Miller is now on Mondays at 5. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and on this show we talk with writers, poets, literary agents, and editors about the art and business of writing. Today I have two guests. In the first half hour, we'll be talking with National Book Award-winning poet Gerald Stern. And in the second half hour, my guest will be poet Elida Rodriguez, who just won the Penn Center USA West Literary Prize 2000. My first guest was on the show a year ago. Gerald Stern is the author of 10 books of poetry. He is recipient of many awards, including the Lamont Prize, a Guggenheim, 3 NEA Awards, and the National Book Award. He's taught at many universities, including Columbia University, New York University, Sarah Lawrence College, and until his retirement in 1995, he taught at the Writers' Workshop in Iowa City. Welcome, Jerry. Are you there?
I'm here.
Hello. How are you?
Well, I'm good.
You're good? Are you
I'm
over your cold?
I'm fairly good. I've been a little ill the last couple of weeks, last month or so.
A summer cold?
Sitting on the back porch of my beloved's house, Anne Marie McCary. And it's a strange situation. She's packing all her belongings to move to my town, Lambertville, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And I was desperately looking for one of my books in case you would ask me to read a poem or something like that.
Did you find it?
Well, I did find one copy of Last Blue.
Excellent.
It's really not even the finished book.
That's all right.
Although the book's been out for 2 months. It's the old uncorrected proofs where the pages aren't numbered, so it's going to be awkward finding things, but we have something to work on.
This is a wonderful book. I received it about a week ago from your publisher.
Right.
And it's wonderful. Do you have a favorite poem in this book?
I maybe do. And I have several favorites for different reasons. The first poem in the book, for example, which is too long to read now, called One of the Smallest, is a kind of special study of light and darkness.
Mm-hmm.
There are several short narrative poems that interest me a great deal. One called Drowning on the Pamas River. Some of the poems would require a lot of explanation to get into. The title poem, for example, Last Blue, or the last poem in the book, which is about the concept of kingdom, the ideal place, kingdom come,
mm-hmm.
which is called kingdom. So I've got many favorites.
Will you read one?
Okay, let me read, start off, because we're going to talk, right?
Yes.
Let me read a short one. Yeah, it's going to be hard to find these things, called Drowning on the Pamas River.
Mm-hmm.
And Anne Marie is sitting beside me, and she's helping me out, because I'm operating with one hand with a telephone, and she's searching for the poems, which don't have page numbers.
Mm-hmm.
But which just say 00.
How long does it take you to write a book of poems of this nature?
3 years.
3 years.
But this is about 3 years worth of stuff, although I seem to be writing faster and faster the older I get. I'm more direct, more literal, less. I almost don't make any corrections as I go along. I've just finished a group of 28 poems, all of which are 20 or 21 lines long. This is after this book.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to call them 28 American sonnets, I believe, although they're not sonnets, they're 21 lines.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote that in about eight or 9 months. But this poem, that the first one you asked me to, with one I suggest I will read,
yes,
is about a little river at the Cape, up in New England,
mm-hmm.
and Cape Cod. It's called called the Pamet River. It's a tidal river, so, and it's only 3 miles long. But you have to read the charts every morning to see which way the tides are coming, or you could be swept out to sea in no time, which almost happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I describe it in a very simple narrative, the lyric poem, in about 12 or 13 lines.
Okay.
And the fourth word in the poem is pool, P-U-L-L.
Okay.
Because of the pool, I ended up swimming in the grasses 100 yards from nowhere. My beloved is ready to jump in after me, a black willow rushing in to save me, my kind of dolphin. You think I struggled a yard at a time, but I was nudged a little. That's why my lips were red instead of blue. That's why I had the words to the dipsy doodle still on my tongue, and I was waltzing under your huge white towel, your bathrobe over my head, hot tea already burning my throat. That's why I love the two Labradors so much. That's why I kissed you so desperately.
Hmm. Now, when you do a book like this, and you know it takes you 3 years, are you consciously working on poems for the book, or are you just
simply working on poems?
No, I
never do that. I never think of it. I'm still blessed by a kind of crude innocence, so I don't think of myself professionally. I don't think of poetry as a profession. I just write my poems,
mm-hmm.
and I still have the same enthusiasm for that I did when I was 18 or 19. And I just write, you know, poem after poem after poem, and then after a couple of years, I say, hey, this is going to be a book. And it seems to be focusing a little more this time on nature or on New York City or on the canal behind my house and the river in Lambertville, or on memories of, you know, childhood or whatever. And at that point, I become a little self-conscious and actually structure it towards becoming a book, and I focus that way. But I don't ever think of writing, not that it's wrong, not that somebody else couldn't do it, a book of poems according to, say, a theme. I've never done that.
So when you choose the poems for the book, are there a lot of poems that don't make it in that you file away?
You know, I don't file them away. I throw them away.
Really?
Yeah.
If they don't make it in, they're gone.
I probably saved them somewhere. No, I'll never find them in this life.
Mm-hmm.
I've written so many poems and so many books that I don't have to be worried and guard each poem as if it's, you know, made of gold, and God save us, God forbid we should lose it. I don't have that kind of attitude to it. I am fairly merciless with my own poems.
Mm-hmm.
And when I do make my choice, that's it, I stick to it. Can you hear that airplane?
Yes, I do. Sounds awfully close.
It's about a foot above my head. And I'm sitting outside on the porch. It's actually a helicopter, probably looking for some illegal immigrants. I don't know where illegal immigrants come from around here. We're about an hour north of New York City in a suburb called Mount Kisco,
mm-hmm.
a little town. So
yes.
that's, I guess, it's kind of answered to your question.
Yes. This is Writers on Writing, 88.9 FM in Irvine. My guest is Gerald Stern. It seems you've been writing poetry since you were just a kid, and you only started publishing in your 40s. Why is that?
Well, actually, that's not 100% accurate. It's about 90% accurate.
All right.
I actually started to publish, you know, 19, 20, 21, 22. Published a lot in my early 20s in various magazines. But for one reason or another, which is a mystery to me, let alone any critic who might take an interest in my work, I never got my collections together and started as my comrades did, my compatriots, Adrian Rich, Robert Bly, Phil Levine, James Wright, writing my first interesting and perhaps bad book of poetry, and then followed by another, and finally the third book becomes the original, the first truly original book. I waited and waited and waited, and I was my own worst critic, and I just prevented the poems from taking a form. So it's like I buried my first two or three books in trunks or in the attic. And I really think it was a smart move. They deserve to be buried.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
I wrote a couple of good poems in my early 20s, but, you know, I didn't hit stride till I was in my late 30s, and I didn't start publishing till in a serious way till my mid-40s.
Hmm. I find your work bittersweet. I find it emotional. What effect do you hope your work has on your readers?
I like bittersweet. I like emotional. In a poem, one of these American sonnets I spoke about earlier that I finished yesterday, the last line of the poem, I use the terms pity and anger. And, of course, it's hard to describe what pity is, and if that's self-pity, if that's tenderness, if that's consideration, or what it is. I thought of love and anger, but that seemed too much full of vainglory and self-praise to say love and anger. But maybe love and anger is accurate, or affection and anger. Certainly anger belongs there as well as pity. Hmm. And so if my reader can respond to that, if they can respond to the feeling, to the identification with all the things and the people and the cities and country places I identify with the simplicity of the vision, and most of all, with the feeling. For me, poetry is not an intellectual activity only, but a consummate act of expression,
mm-hmm.
emotional expression.
Would you read another?
I'll read another. Let me find my glasses, put them on my face. I'm going to read a poem, honey. I'm not calling you honey, I'm calling Anne Marie, honey. Would you help me find this poem, Whatever Paris Meant? This is a poem about Paris. I have two poems in this book about Paris. One is called Paris, and the other is called Whatever Paris Meant. And I spent a good portion of my 20s moving back and forth between New York City on the one hand and Paris and Florence and Vienna and other places in Europe on the other. And this describes living in Paris in 1950. I was on the GI Bill, result of being in the army in World War II. I lived in this little hotel. There were a group of starving expatriate Romanians living there, and we would go out for soup in the middle of the night the way you did in those days. So it goes like this. It wasn't until Monday, November 14th, 1994, that I decided Offenbach was too glutted and the umpap I would have to go. Though sometimes my mood changed and all the spitefulness of that half century was converted to the pleasure of understanding the oh yes and ah yes I learned in my first 10 years behind two pillars in a room full of starched curtains. Whatever Paris meant in 1950, whatever of Gide was in the air, and pitched battles over Coca-Cola and the wearing of black behind a piece of horse meat, there still was enough, thanks God, of the Bella Bella to last a few more years. And there was a man who carried a leather bag of small red Bibles. He was our personal fury and stood over us singing Jeunesse Passe, youth passes, and Jeunesse Passe, something between a crow and a sparrow. It was our cry for over a year. It was the greeting between us. Once at 3 in the morning when my Romanians woke me up for soup, we pounded each other on the bridge going over and sang it in French and German. Something of Offenbach was in our hearts. We jumped up on the rails and fell to the sidewalk on our knees. We did it all night. In the morning when I wrote and waited for my Britain to make my bed so I could bend over her, I wiped those drums out and buried those Romanians. I didn't know about sighing yet. I just stared at the fixture, and she fell asleep with her hand on my shoulder. I walk with my two arms waving sometimes. I am explaining, and I have the limp I started in Paris, a kind of rolling from side to side. I still crash into male and female hydrants. I still lean against the metal poles to stretch my hamstrings, and I still do a dream walk from one end of New York to the other, west to east and south to north. The music goes oompa, oompa, oompa. The words are jeunesse passe and jeunesse passe. The window faced a Moroccan smoke shop. The street was empty.
Thank you. You're listening to Writers on Writing in our new time slot. My guest is National Book Award winning poet Gerald Stern. There's so many details in your poems. Are you constantly taking notes of what you're observing, or do you simply have an excellent memory?
It's in that crazy storehouse called my mind. I almost never take notes. Well, sometimes I do of little things, which I almost never use. The words come generally rushing out in a kind of torrent, and I'm always a little surprised at the endless array of details. It's as if I am stuck in the woods and describing the individual trees, and I don't realize till the poem is written how a mass called a forest is being generated there.
Mm-hmm.
And each poem is a kind of forest, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't wander around with a little notebook taking notes.
So if your work comes out,
I'm a sponge. I just absorb everything that comes into view. You've got to be very careful not to come close to me because you get invited into a poem one way or another.
So,
I'm sorry, you were saying?
Well, if it all comes out in a torrent, then what sort of revision do you put your work through? Do you subject it through?
The truth is, I hate to use this word because it's a psychological term and a Freudian term, though I have nothing against it. Psychology or Freud, but I hate to use that to explain poetry. It comes out of what most familiarly we would call the unconscious or the preconscious or the dark place or the unacknowledged place. I have faith that the poem is organized that way. Of course, I do all kinds of conscious efforts. I'm well schooled. I speak several languages. I know English and American poetry pretty thoroughly. I'm not professing any kind of primitivism. But I do trust something happening down there, or maybe it's up there, in a way of speaking on its own. And that may be the creative process. I know it sounds simplistic and it sounds mysterious, but I think that's truer than other things maybe. It doesn't mean I don't struggle over language and come back over and over again to a poem while I'm writing it and change lines and cut out these 10 lines and add those 7 lines and do all the things that any other poet does. But I guess my poetry belongs, for good or ill, at the opposite end of the rational. You want to call it the irrational?
Mm.
Or the unrational, or the pre-rational, or the super. How about we call it the super-rational? And we say that what is rational is a form of futility and madness.
Mm.
And I'm in the real rational world.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Will you read another? We have
a
few minutes left.
I've got to find my glasses. I constantly take my glasses off. Honey, which poem shall I read? She wants me to read another. I know what I'm going to read. I'm going to read a poem for Larry Levis, a dear friend of mine, a wonderful poet who died 3.5 years ago, who died betimes. He was just 60 when he died suddenly of a heart attack. Excuse me, just 50. I said 60. In this poem, I was living in one of my cities called Easton, PA, Easton, Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. an old city, and I encountered, as it were in a dream, Larry Levis outside walking on the street during the first snowfall that year. And the poem is called Larry Levis Visits Easton, PA During a November Freeze. And Anne Marie is now going to do me the honor. You see it?
Okay.
Finding that poem.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know how many of your readers know Larry Levis. I think he was a great poet.
Mm.
And his death, of course, aside from the deep sadness of losing a dear friend, a wonderful, kind human being, we lost a very important poet. Luckily, his former teacher, Phil Levine, put his poems together posthumously in a book of his called Elegy, which was published a couple years ago by the University of Pittsburgh Press. His poem is in couplets. I said, "Dear Larry," as I put down his book, Elegy, across the street from the Home Energy Center and its two embellished secular Christmas trees and its two red wreaths over red ribbon crosses enshrining a 30-inch stove in one of its windows and a 50-gallon water heater in the other, knowing how wise he would have been with the parking lot and the tree that refused against all odds and all sane agreements and codicils to let its dead leaves for God's sake fall in some kind of trivial decency, and how he would have stopped with me always beside him to watch a girl in a white fur parka and boots spill the first snowball on Northampton Street she collected from the hood of a Ford Fairlane underneath that tree and throw it, she thought, at a small speed limit sign, although it landed with a fluff just shy of the twin-painted center lines, inducing the three of us, her lover, Larry, and I, to make our own snowballs from the hoods and fenders of our own fair lanes. Although she threw like none of us, and to add to it, she was left-handed. So bless her. May she have a good job and children and always be free of cancer. And may the two of us scrape some roofs before the rain relieves us. And may we find gloves for our labor.
Mm, very nice. You're listening to Writers on Writing. My guest is Gerald Stern, author of Last Blue. Jerry, we're coming to the end of our time.
It was pretty quick, wasn't it?
It goes so quick. What's good training for poets?
I'm of six minds about whether they should go to school or not.
Mm-hmm.
I taught for 15 years or so at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, so I should be the last person to tell them not to do that, and that's a good thing to do. You can't prescribe in advance what's good for one poet or another poet. You can certainly say what's bad. It's bad to be pompous, to close yourself off, to become too academic, to not to open all your pores, to take your final job when you're 28 years old, or your final wife, or what have you.
Yes.
You should give yourself to music, to languages, and to reading, above all, to reading. For poets are merely readers who occasionally write a poem.
Mm. Well, I thank you again for being on the show.
Barbara, thank you so much. Is there a chance I could get a copy of this tape?
You sure can.
You know my address.
I sure do.
I don't want to say it over the phone because I'll get 700 letters.
That's right.
It's real great talking to you, Barbara.
Thank you, and get well.
Thanks.
Okay, bye-bye. That was Gerald Stern, author of Last Blue. My next guest will be on in a few minutes. Until that time, we're going to take a quick break. Do stay tuned. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and we're in our new time slot. We'll be here till 6 o'clock today. So don't go away, and I will be back with our next poet.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI. We're in Irvine, California. And for those of you listening on the internet, we're about an hour north of Mexico, so thanks for tuning in. My next guest is Aleida Rodriguez, and she is quite a published poet. First of all, she was born on a kitchen table in Cuba, and her poetry and prose has been published widely, including Plowshares, Prairie Schooner, The Kenyon Review, and Ziziva. She's received a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship in Poetry, and she just won the Penn Center USA West Literary Prize 2000 for the best book of poetry published the previous year by an author or press west of the Mississippi. Welcome, Aleida. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, how are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm good. Tell me about this book of poems. How did it come to be? Were these pieces that were published in journals, and at a certain point you saw a running theme, or you saw a book here?
I just listened to your talk with Gerald Stern, and it was kind of a similar thing where I published little things here and there in literary magazines since like the age of 20, and every once in a while I thought I had a collection, but it never really was anything, even though I sent it out. I sent it out for about 15 years, various places. It always got rejected, and that always gave me the impetus to rework it. And so this is actually the most recent version of everything that I thought was bad thrown out.
Garden of Exile, the name of the book. Where did the name come from? Where did the title come from?
Well, I'm a Cuban exile. Mm-hmm. I was born in Cuba in 53, and I came here as one of the Peter Pan children, airlifted out of Cuba during the early 60s, and I was placed in a foster home in Illinois. So exile is pretty much underlined on my life, even though I don't always like to refer to it directly as subject matter. So it just, you know, it's present in my life as a metaphor and all the feelings that come with being exiled.
Mm-hmm. Have you been back to Cuba?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, many times.
And how does your heritage figure into your work?
It doesn't really influence me very much anymore, except on a very foundational level.
Mm-hmm.
People expect me to write about Cuba all the time, and if I don't, that means I'm not a Cuban writer. And if I don't write in Spanish, you know, that's a bad thing. But, you know, I'm 47 years old, and I have been writing all my life and publishing since I was like 20 years old. So my first few poems, I really did deal with that material. It was sort of the top that I skimmed off. And now I feel like I'm dealing with stuff that's more eccentric, mm-hmm. more like my fingerprints than anything, ethnically or, you know, any other way, you know, racially, ethnically. You know, I don't feel, I identify very much as being Cuban,
mm-hmm.
very much. Very proud of that. You can hardly ever meet a Cuban who isn't proud of being Cuban.
Mm-hmm.
But as a writer, or as an artist, any kind of artist, I don't think that that is the primary, or should be, in my idea, the primary material. It might influence how you talk about the world, or it might, a lot of people see like sadness or longing in my work, and I think that's probably there from that early experience.
Hmm. Will you read to us?
What would you like?
Oh, gosh. How about one of the painting poems?
Okay. I'll do a beep at one of the FCC-censored words.
Oh, good.
This one's called... Well, I have a... One of my strongest interests is in visual art and painting. In particular, I used to work at a museum, but I had it, you know, the interest way before that. And so this particular painting is called Plein Air,
mm-hmm.
and it's because I'm... If I could paint... That's what I would do. I would do plein air paintings. I'm lucky enough to have a 1930s California plein air painting that I inherited, and that's exactly what I would do. They look like paintings out of social studies books, you know, those illustrations
mm-hmm.
from school, and I just love the kind of naive quality of that.
Yes.
So this is my sort of ars poetica about painting versus writing.
Okay.
Plein air. I'd like to explain how difficult it is to work with words. A painter sits down and lines up little tubes of color cleansed of context. The autistic tubes in a row utter nary a sentence, don't waggle with admonishment or squirm with shame. There's no fear their tiny silver mouths will whisper, mustache or fat immigrant, you never or I always or don't. No one has hissed cadmium yellow in a fit of rage, or spat chrome oxide green while walking out the door. Free from these radioactive insinuations, the painter can open up the top of her head, release the words blackening its ceiling like trapped smoke, and go to work with the vocabulary of another planet. Her materials are as forgiving as leaves, which care not whether she says detergent instead of iconoclast. When she opens up the case, the colors are all there, exactly as she left them, not dangling between her and the checkout clerk. They're pristine, untroubled, idiot savants with an amnesiac satin memory. She doesn't have to autoclave each one before she picks it up. There should be such a box for writers, filled with words brightly minted, but spared the smudge of circulation. Words denied to cruel, rapacious partners, jealous co-workers, spin doctors and ad copywriters. Words one could pick up and squeeze a little bit of on a palette, add a splotch of medium and swirl to just the right syrupy consistency. Thus preserved, these words would sweep the mind free of muddle, the sky of pollution, and virginal as illustrations in social studies books before we understood the West was actually lost. Blue-creased mountains would loom, crisply visible, their presence saying simply, winter, saying, late afternoon, saying, here.
I love this one. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and my guest is poet Aleida Rodriguez, author of Garden of Exile. As I was reading these, especially these painting poems, of course, I, for a second, had a really odd experience because I began thinking you were a painter and not a poet, and I was trying to figure out who was coming on the show.
Uh-huh.
It's interesting.
People think, even after I've told them I'm not a painter, someone just left a message on my phone machine the other day saying, good luck with your painting and your poetry. And I thought, where are they? Well, okay.
Yeah.
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 I wish I were, but I'm not.
Hmm. Have you been a poet since you began writing, or did you find your way to poetry through another writing genre?
the very first thing that I remember writing was in the fifth grade. I loved mystery stories, and I was a big fan of, like, Sherlock Holmes.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote this mock Sherlock Holmes story called, and this is an interesting thing, The Case of the Strange Paintings, in which the paintings had mechanical eyes and, you know, saw where this, like, emerald was being hidden, and then later they came and stole it, blah, blah, blah. But that's the first thing, and I still have it, you know, in pencil, you know, with this little sketch of, you know, Sherlock Holmes and his wing chair on the back of the paper, you know, that kind of thing. But that was, you know, in the fifth grade, and then I started reading poetry in junior high and loved it all. I mean, not the you know, Rime of the Ancient Mariner kind of stuff, but I did like, you know, what people consider more traditional, like Edna St. Vincent Millay. I really loved her.
Mm-hmm.
I really appreciated her sense of humor. I didn't think she was stuffy. And then by high school, I had discovered Ferlinghetti, and I just adored him. I loved the way that the words swam back and forth across the page, and I became very, you know, imitative of him. And I liked his sensibility. He was celebrating everything all the time. And I really resonate with that.
Mm-hmm. Do you still teach poetry in the schools?
Occasionally. Mm-hmm. Not. I did that for a very long time. The first time that I taught was like 1976. And I think the last class I did was like 2 years ago. And I got really burnt out on it because I was doing it through a California Arts Council grant and put in an elementary school, and it completely burned me out.
Mm-hmm.
So now what I choose to do is that I do poetry workshops, but for adults, very limited, like 10-week or a week-long thing, you know, something like that.
Mm-hmm. How do you teach poetry?
I don't. You know, that's something now, because I'm leaving on Sunday to teach at Flight of the Mind in Oregon, and I'm trying, and I have sample work of the student. I'm going to have 15 students with whom I meet every day for a week. And you can't really teach anyone. That's what I'm about to, you know, tell them. And I'm getting together all sorts of proof. all you can do is infect them, you know, mm-hmm. make your enthusiasm for that contagious. And it won't take with everybody. I mean, I think what Gerald said about a writer is a reader who sometimes writes a poem.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that you first have to be someone who loves words and has really no ambition, really, to do anything with it other than to have the writing be. This will sound too much like a self-help thing. I don't mean it this way, but as a connection to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I was having dinner with Joanne Beard, the wonderful essayist, last I think it was Monday, and she was saying that she had first started out painting, and then when she discovered writing, discovered that that's the thing that people were always talking about, that connection. When you feel a passion for something, that you think you have found the form of expression in the world that allows you to say who you are or to connect. It's external, but it allows you to connect back to you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what it does for me, and I hope to pass that on.
Yes. Well, do you come in, you must come in contact with students who either had a bad experience with poetry in, say, high school or college, and they just feel frustrated with it, or they feel frustrated that they don't get it?
Mm-hmm.
What do you do with people, with students that come to you with sort of, that are sort of jaded and who really need to become infected?
I know what it's like to be jaded. I know what it's like when I first was forced to read that stuff that I hated in school. I thought, if this is what writing is, I want nothing to do with it. It felt dead. Once I was a visiting poet at an elementary school, and the kids said, oh, we thought all poets had to be dead. I mean, that was a part of the definition. You know, if you were a poet, it meant that you were dead. They could, you know, me standing in front of them was sort of like blowing their mind. And so there are a lot of dead people. And I think that now the way to, like, for instance, some of the books that I'm taking, I take, whenever I teach, I take this canvas carpenter's bag full of, like, my favorite books.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the books that I'm going to be taking for this class, because somebody said they're into language and somebody else is really into traditional, is that I'm going to try to please everyone by giving them what it is, to encourage them to say, not to say what I want to say or how I think something should be said, but to lead them in the direction of what they want to say. So if they are really jaded, like some teenager in ninth grade or something, then you say, well, say it how you want to say it. And in the language, invent your own language. If you think this is inauthentic or, you know, not cool or whatever, what are the words? And then, you know, it challenges them to find the language to express it in the way that they want. And as long as they are engaged with their own experience and in their own words, something will come out of it.
This is Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. My guest is poet Aleida Rodriguez, author of Garden of Exile. So what sort of poetry interests you the most? Language, traditional, classics, what do you like?
I really like a wide range. I mean, as I said, my first influence was like Edna St. Vincent Millay, and then I went from that very traditional thing to like Ferlinghetti. I'm a double Gemini. I'm allowed to do these things. I go around and get attracted to all sorts of things. What I read a lot is people who are doing things that I wish that I could do and that I think are very brave. Like for now, I'm reading Ann Carson, a lot of Ann Carson, and I started out reading her Eros the Bittersweet, that nonfiction book about Eros and the classics. And I thought I hated the classics. I refused to take, you know, the classics when I was in school. And she awakened me to them, and it's all around the whole issue of Eros. I found out through her discussion of Eros how it's a triangular relationship, the lover, beloved, and then the space in between. It's, you know, always that tripod. I found out that I have that relationship with Cuba, you know, that kind of thing. And that third element in my writing comes from that third invisible thing, that Eros can only exist in the space, so there's a lot of space. So I like, and she doesn't care what it looks like. Well, this is what I say. She doesn't care, but of course she cares very deeply about what something looks like on a page. But what it doesn't look like anybody else's. She throws in prose. She quotes, you know, Emily Bronte at length. You know, she lifts text, sticks it in. She talks about, you know, popular culture. TV Man was one, a series that she has. And it's all so bizarre that when I'm reading it, I am both frightened and excited. You know, this is never, I've never seen anything like this before. How does she have the courage to put something down that she hasn't seen in the world anywhere? I mean, all of us are afraid of rejection, and if when we come up with something that is like this weird form that we just throw on a page, and nothing has ever looked like that before, most of us, you know, will put it back in a drawer and say, well, it's, you know, half cooked or whatever. She just says, this is me. I'm quirky, I'm eccentric, and these are my interests, and I'm going to indulge them. And so that's the people that I love. And another person that I adore, it's completely different, for completely different reasons, Marie Howe. You know, I really love her lines. I think she's really elegant, and I like her subject matter. Some people think that that's too, you know, cloying or whatever, but I really appreciate it. I especially liked her first book, The Good Thief, very, very much. It influenced me tremendously. Some of the poems in this book are influenced by that.
Interesting. Will you read another?
Do you have a preference of any?
Oh, gee, I like so many. I like so many of them. I like Ontology. I like all of your painting poems, of course. I like Eclipse, but I don't want you to read something too short.
Okay.
Let's see. What do you like a lot here?
I don't know. I like The Invisible Body at the end, even though most people find it so obtuse, because it was the last thing that I wrote before the book kind of pulled itself together. And in fact, the publisher tried to talk me out of putting it in. And I said, no, I think that I should close the book with it because I think this is the direction I'm heading in, and I want to give it as a kind of flag of what I'm going to do next.
Well, let's hear it then.
Okay. It ain't short.
That's all right.
Okay. I work as a translator and an editor. That's what I do for a living mostly. And I spend a lot of time in dictionaries, and the Velazquez Dictionary is one of my favorite things because you get old terms that are no longer like in the Oxford Spanish-English Dictionary. So I was doing a translation one day, and I came across this term called regla lesbia, and I had never seen that before. I mean, I know what the word regla means. It means rule. Lesbia is not lesbian in Spanish, so I didn't know what the hell that was. So I went and tried to find it by itself in the dictionary, and it doesn't exist by itself. It only exists in combination with this word. And the definition is a flexible rule that may be adjusted to any body to be measured. Compare regla fija, standard, Well, regla fija made perfect sense to me because fija is fixed, so a fixed rule would be a standard. But what is this lesbia thing, and how come that's flexible, and how come it measures bodies but not objects? Why is the word maybe adjusted to any body to be measured? And I was so captivated by that, and, you know, I scribbled it down, and I went on and did my job, and I thought, this has something to do with this poem that it's on its way. And I kept hearing, almost like a mantra for a few weeks before that, the invisible body, everywhere I went. In my head, I was hearing this, so I thought, I wonder if this regla lesbia has something to do with the invisible body. So that is actually the superscript for the poem, the epigraph, and it comes out of the Velazquez Dictionary. It's in 7 parts.
Okay.
And this one was very much influenced by Marie Howe, the couplets. I really like the way they look on the page. 1. In the garden, it's there. Even when you're inside, you feel it, as though it were you standing naked among the weeds, the tips of the bougainvillea bursting into flame, your nipples ruffled like the skin of a lake by a breeze. You worship the invisible body like an old-fashioned lover from afar, loving the specificity of space between you. Sometimes at night it stretches out on the empty side of the bed, stares at you with the length of its invisible surface. Every contour of your body not filled by you is molded by the attentiveness of the invisible body whose breath surrounds you. It's more than prayer it wants, more than language with its conditions. The invisible body demands you invent new senses to receive it, new places on your body to marvel at its subtlety, like the eyes of the deaf percussionist that perceives sound. 2. The invisible body wants you to become a satellite dish tuned to what exists only because your body calls to it. Like the woman who had her kitchen remodeled to make room for the microwave she'd entered a contest for, then won. 3. When asked whether falling in love was about acquisitiveness, about the ego, the 75-year-old poet responded that the ego had nothing to do with it. It was the need for union with the beloved. Rumi asks, who is it we spend our entire lives loving? 4. How, then, do you measure the invisible body, which resists commitment but is faithful? Is it clear who the beloved is when no clear body exists that can be measured against a standard? 5. The invisible body sometimes acquires a body. It's so convincing, it takes you a while to figure out it's really the invisible body. Like someone who has been reading your journal, it has decoded from your petty daily complaints the open sesame that slides the stone from the hidden cave's opening and cleans you out while you sleep, leaving a sarcastic note. It wants you to know it was doing you a favor. Besides, how else did you think you'd discover the cave's precise location? When Aphrodite sharpens you, you sacrifice a little of yourself, willingly, as a knife does, so that you may become better at it. 6. This is the point at which the invisible body speaks in italics, the Ouija board of poetry. In my mind, says the invisible body, that time capsule shuttling through space, I hold in all the languages of the world your love, rushed like holographic platters to a table, steaming into the future long after you cease to shine, the silver faces of your beloved bobbing out of the darkness, the black velvet pillow of your life on which you offer them for view. 7. The invisible body is created out of your longing compressing invisible molecules together into an absence you recognize. That is the way one blind man sees the world after the fact, and photographs he took once he had passed through it.
Thank you. That was Elena Rodriguez reading from The Garden of Exile. How do you know when a poem is finished?
I'm pretty obsessive. I work on it forever. I like just working on it. I know people who work on several poems at a time and feel that works for them. I have to be like the lover of a poem at the moment,
mm-hmm.
and I have to give it nothing but my attention for, you know, 3 weeks or a month or whatever, and doing nothing but tinkering with it until, and being open to it during that time that other ideas may come, not just what's on the page. So I don't know that, except that at the end, I think, does this come close to what I wanted to say? It's never really what I wanted to say, but does it come close to my original intention?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, am I moved? A lot of times I spend, you know, it sounds silly and very feminine, but I cry when I write sometimes because things are so, the language, the words themselves are moving. So when I get to that point of feeling like that one word next to another word makes me feel moved, then that I feel like I'm starting to get to the end where the thing feels cooked.
Mm-hmm. One last question. How important is your environment to writing?
Very.
Do you have to be in a certain room, or does it have to be a certain time?
It doesn't have to be, because poems come at any time.
Mm-hmm.
But I work at home, and I have made that be my life, so that the first and best energy I can give it to my own work. And I also, my studio opens to the backyard, and I really need to have, you know, my parrot and my garden and the opening, you know, to the outside, so that I can wander out there and just stare, you know, when I'm working.
Mm-hmm.
I don't relate well to modern environments. I'd never liked offices, you know, so it has to be someplace where I feel like that the concrete things of the world can drop away and other less tangible things can arise.
Yes. Actually, I do have one more question, and that is, if you have any advice for the writers listening.
About how to go about writing?
Anything. Poetry.
It's not about ego. It's about being a channel for something that was wordless until it got to you. I mean, Rilke says that about how, you know, in our grandparents' time, you know, cloak, well, gate, whatever had a lot of meaning for them. And he thinks that objects, everyday objects, have no way of crossing over into the other world except through us. So I think that when one writes, one is allowing something to cross over and become eternal or immortal. Those are his words. And so it can't be about you. You have to be in the service of something that can't speak for itself.
Hmm. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
I wish we had more time.
This went very quickly.
You will have to come back.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Aleida Rodriguez,
author of The Garden of Exile. If you have any comments or questions, please email me at writersonwriting.com. And if you want to know who will be on my show next, go to my website, same place, and you can get to my email through that. We'll be back next Thursday at 5 p.m. with more authors. And I'd like to leave you with a quote by Mark Twain, who said, "The difference between the right word and the almost right word is the difference between lightning and the lightning bug." This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Thanks for listening.